It is so important to me and to all of us, I believe, that we have an insight. I talk to so many new people who say, how did this begin? How could Lord put up with all these things? How did this hold together and gel and make it what it is today? And I have to believe that if it hadn't been for my wife, I'd have never made it. I know of it. And I have to believe if it hadn't been for Lois, Bill would have never made it. Because at that little coffee table was Dr. Bob and Bill, and Lois pouring the coffee. If those things hadn't happened, we wouldn't be here today sober. That's my belief. So I asked my beautiful wife to meet, to introduce Lois. Will you, honey?
This is the dividend of Al-Anon. We heard about the dividends in AA. This is truly a pleasure. Lois does not need an introduction to this group, but it's my very happy privilege to present her to you. We all know her and love her as the wife of a late beloved co-founder of AA. Not only that, she is an illustrious person in her own right. And we are singularly honored that she will join us in our convention here. Lois has given so much of herself, of her time and her wisdom to the families of AAs, and for that we all are so deeply appreciative. And it's with great respect and admiration, and I consider it a great, great privilege to present her to you at this time, Lois W. My cheeks and ears are red. I don't know how to begin after all those wonderful words. But I do know that I'm extremely, extremely grateful to having been invited here and to Cersei's very persuasive arguments, which I resisted for quite a while, but finally couldn't, and I'm so glad that I couldn't. And I want to thank you all for your tremendous hospitality. There's nothing like, I think, Dallas hospitality and joviality and happiness. There's a glow about you all that is most warming. And I thank you from the bottom of my heart for all your kindness. And I thank you for your great enthusiasm for carrying on AA and Al-Anon. People can start a thing, but it can have a stillbirth if it isn't nourished and carried on with devotion and enthusiasm. And those that do that are really just as important to the movement as the first ones that started it. And speaking of the first ones, I thought maybe I'd tell you a little bit about Eddie, the man who came to Bill. You folks here in Dallas were so very, very good to Eddie. And I know many of you remember him. And I thought maybe you'd be interested to hear a little bit about his background and his early life. When I was a young girl, we used to go to Vermont. In fact, all my childhood, we went to a place called Manchester, Vermont, for the summertime. My father was a doctor, and we used to go up there for half the year, practically, the children did. And Eddie's family did the same thing. It was a summer resort, very beautiful place. Eddie's family had been coming there for years and years. They were an old Albany family. Eddie's grandfather was the mayor of Albany. Eddie's uncle was the mayor of Albany. And his brother was the mayor of Albany. It was a tradition to have a Thatcher, a mayor. But Mrs. Thatcher had, I can't really say whether they were alcoholics or not, but had a very heavily drinking husband and five very heavily drinking boys. And she must have had a gay old man. I have a picture of Eddie when he was about 3 feet tall. I guess. He was a friend of my brother's, my younger brother's. And they used to do all kinds of mischievous things together. And then one year, the Thatcher family thought it would be good for Eddie if he went to Manchester to the school that was there. There was a boarding school in Manchester. And Eddie spent the winter and went to school. And it was there that he met Bill. Because Bill had been brought up in Vermont in a very small town just a few miles away from Manchester. And he went to this high school, boarding school, too, and they became quite chummy. The town of Manchester has, I can't tell you how many stories about Eddie's escapade. He was always doing something. As I say, all the brothers drank, but Eddie was the youngest, and he was certainly a real alcoholic. And he was always into some kind of a big mess of some sort. I remember one time he was driving along, and this was way back in the early days of automobiles. He was driving along and just casually went into somebody's window, through the window. The front wheels of an automobile sat on the kitchen floor. And Eddie got out of the automobile very nonchalantly and said, "How about a cup of coffee?" When I was thinking what I'd say the other day, it occurred to me, well, maybe that's why all AAs like coffee so much. Going way back then. And Bill and Eddie did a lot of drinking together later. I remember one time Bill stopped over in Albany to see Eddie. And at that time, Manchester had just started to open. It wasn't quite ready yet. An airport. They thought it would be nice to have the wealthy people with planes of their own have a place to land. So a small airfield was being opened. And Eddie, of course, knew all about this. So when Bill stopped in Albany to see him, he said, "Let's go to Manchester and let's hire an airplane and we'll be the first people to land on that new airfield in Manchester." Maybe Brian Young stop and go back and tell you a little bit more about Eddie's background and say that his family were quite a well-to-do family. And they were in the stove building, stove foundry, I think they called it. And Eddie had gone through that from top to bottom, as all the brothers had, for the experience so they could manage it. But he hadn't any other business experience or any other business training. He'd just gone through high school, but he had read a lot. And he had been left, really, a unfortunately, he had been left a lot of money. And that can do really, a very great deal of harm. Anyway, Eddie hadn't ever had to work, so he didn't know how really to work, didn't know where to start or how to begin. So the chartering of a plane, there wasn't anything too much in those days for Eddie to do. So they chartered this plane and called up the people in Manchester and told them that they would arrive. Well, this was a very great excitement for the town. So they got out the band and they got out welcoming committee. And Bill and Eddie, of course, had a bottle or maybe two or three with them on the plane. So when they arrived, they were completely out and just fell out of the plane. So that was their arrival. This was to music, to the band. And speaking of music, I've enjoyed the organ that I've been hearing being played here all the time during this, both last night and today during this luncheon. Well, Bill and Eddie had a lot of other experiences together. Eddie used to come to New York and see us, but he never arrived unless he was drunk. But then, one day, Eddie called up Bill, and Bill was sitting in the kitchen with a pitcher. Somehow or other, he thought if he put pineapple juice with gin, that I wouldn't object to it so much. And he put it in the pitcher. Anyway, Eddie called up Bill and said he wanted to come over and see him. So when Eddie arrived, Bill was flabbergasted to see him, because Eddie's eye was clear. He wasn't drinking. He hadn't been drinking, apparently. And his thinking was straightforward. And so Bill asked him about how come, Eddie, you're not drinking. And Eddie said, no, he come specially over to see Bill to tell him about this new experience that he'd had, and that he'd got religion. Well, Bill didn't have religion, at least so-called religion at that time, and he rebelled at the thought of it. Ebby, religion. Well, then Ebby told him about the Oxford group, that members of which had saved him from going to jail. He had done some thing or other, I don't know what, and he was about to be committed when a couple of friends of his who belonged to the Oxford group had pleaded with the judge and asked him to please let them have Ebby, that they thought they could help him. And so Ebby had come to New York with these friends, and he was living then in what was called Calvary Mission, the Calvary Church in New York on 21st Street. Was the head of the Oxford Group movement in America. And this mission was run by the church and by the Oxford Group. And after Bill and Ebby's talk together, Bill, of course, was tremendously impressed. And I came home and I saw Ebby. We talked together for quite a while, the three of us. And As I say, it made a tremendous impression upon Bill. But he kept on drinking. And after a day or so, he thought, well, I've got to find out more about this. And so he started off for the Calvary mission. But of course, he had to be reinforced before he could go. And along 23rd Street, the mission was down on the east end of 23rd Street in New York, there were many, many bars. And he stopped at most of them on the way down to the mission. And in one, he was standing next to somebody and he asked him about it and he said, he asked this man, what he did for a living, and he said, I'm a fisherman. And somehow or other, the word fisherman struck a chord in Bill's mind. And he said, that's it, I'm on the way to the mission, fishers of men. Come with me, we'll go down to this Calvary mission. So Alec was also a tent maker, I believe, hitched onto Bill, and they went down to the mission. And of course, everybody saw them coming. He was quite flabbergasted and didn't know just what he'd do with them. And they were having a meeting. I guess they had a meeting every night at the mission, where people got up and went to the altar and gave themselves to Christ. And the leader of the meeting asked if there was anybody that wanted to come up. And Bill started up. Well, Abby and somebody else that was on the other side, both grabbed Bill's coattails because, or maybe shirt tails, maybe it was shirt tail, because his shirt tail almost always was hanging out. Anyway, they grabbed onto him, but they couldn't keep him. And he went up in the front. And really, in very great sincerity, did hand over his life to Christ. And then went home, but he brought Alec home with him. And Alec lived with us for many months. But Bill still kept on drinking. But he kept thinking this thing over in his mind and realizing, he had enough sense to realize that he couldn't really think it out, what had happened to Abby while he still drank. So he went to the hospital to get the alcohol out of his system so he'd be able to think clearly. And as you probably all know, because I'm sure you've all read about his spiritual experience in the book, in the big book, Bill's life really was changed from that moment. And he had this tremendous, moving experience. And when I went to see Bill, I knew something much bigger than he had gotten a hold of it. And I never had a doubt about his taking another drink. I was sure that he was through with liquor forever. Well, that brings me up really up to about the first days of AA, but not really. But I think I'll go back now and tell you maybe a little bit of my own side of the experience, side of the drinking experience. When Bill and I were first married, we of course were terribly happy. But before that, when we were engaged, he never took a drop of to drink. His father had too much to drink most of his life, and his grandfather before him. And he'd been warned. His mother and father were separated.
mostly because of alcohol. And he had been warned that he should never take a drink because something awful might happen. And somehow or other, he believed them. And I was very proud when we were engaged of telling people about how wonderful he was, because he'd go to the saloons, as they called them in those days, with the boys and take ginger ale or sarsaparilla root beer or some soft drink of the time. But then the war came along, and Bill had gone to a military school, and so he was a young officer in the war, and stationed in New Bedford, Massachusetts. Now, New Bedford was a cotton town, and there was a lot of money there, and a lot of society, and the society ladies used to like to invite the officers from the post to cocktail parties. And I always liked to kid Bill about he could resist the boys, but when the girls offered him drinks, that was too much. So Bill started drinking. And after we were married, when I moved up there, Bill rented a small apartment, furnished apartment, and I moved up there. And of course, we continued to go to some of these cocktail parties. And the first time I ever saw Bill drunk, or first time I ever saw him drink, and the first time I ever did that, he got drunk, terribly drunk. And the boys had to take him home. And they came to me afterwards, take me home, because they wanted to look after him. They put him in bed, and they got a big bucket put by his head. So when I came home, that was what greeted me. But he didn't drink too much in those days. But he always got drunk. He never had any social drinking. It was never any fun to drink with me, with Bill at all. So that, as I say, I wasn't too worried about it. For one thing, I thought I'd be able to fix him. It never occurred to me but that living with me would give him enough real purpose in life so that he wouldn't need any artificial stimulant. But as time went on, he got worse and worse. And as time went on, we had no children. Things began to look very, very desperate. And I realized my whole purpose in life, as the one of children to bring up, would be to help Bill try to get over this terrific, what I thought was a habit. And he thought, of course, that he could stop any time he wanted to. And he wanted to only halfway for quite a long time. But finally, after he lost job after job, he knew that he wanted really to stop. And I think there's nothing sadder in this world than to see a person with such wonderful potential so beaten down. Bill got so he wanted more than anything in this world to stop. He was so sincere, so anxious about it, he'd write in the Bible, "My dear wife, I promise never to take another drink." He did this, I can't tell you how many times. He'd write me letters. No, he never, never wanted to take another drink. But he was drunk in a few hours, perhaps, after that. And he was just terrifically confused and, oh, so despairing. And we decided that we'd try to fight this thing together. But I didn't know anything about it. I didn't know how. I just knew I loved him and that I believed that he could get well. I didn't call it an illness, but it seemed as if it must be something of the sort. Well, then this wonderful experience happened. And Bill thought, well, goodness gracious, if this has happened to me, why can't it happen to others? I must go out and help all these old friends that I've been drinking with. They must stop too. And so he went out on the highways and the byways, and he brought everybody to our house. We were living in Brooklyn. He brought everybody to our house. My father had lived in one of those old brick houses in the city. It has four stories. And my father, the mortgage company, had gotten the house, and the mortgage company let us live there for $20 a month after my father had left. So we had plenty of room, and he filled the house with drunks. I, of course, by this time, had to make all these decisions. I had to be nursemaid, mother, and financier. I had to support Bill, of course. He wasn't able to do anything at the time Abby had come to him, but sit in the kitchen and drink. He was afraid to go out because he was afraid the police would get him. So, I was still working, of course, after he sobered up, and after he filled the house with drunks. So we really had quite a household. There were so many inspiring stories about those days. There were so many ridiculous, so many tragic things that happened. One man committed suicide in our house. Another man chased still another one around the whole house with a carving knife. We had innumerable adventures of one sort or another. But so a few of those people, very few of them, really stayed sober. We were trying to do it the wrong way, really. We were trying to give them these things, give them that room and board, not always board, but often board. And Bill was preaching to them, really, as he said himself, a little too much. This wonderful spiritual experience that he had set him apart, he felt. And so he was talking a little bit down to these people. And there are one or two of them around now who are still alive that live there in King Street. But most of them stayed sober for a little while. Alec lived there a long time and then left and came back drunk and wanted money, and I wouldn't give it to him. And I've always felt very badly about that somehow or other. And we never saw him after that. And Eddie lived with us for a long time. One of the saddest days was after about 2 years of Eddie's being in the Oxford group, Eddie got drunk. And that, of course, was a terrific calamity to us. And oh, so many really wonderful things happened too. But then Bill began to feel that it was time that he got back into the business world and brought in some cash to the household. So he got a job as an investigator. I'm a little vague about this even now. He went to Akron, where there was several of the stockholders, there was a stockholder fight about who should own the company.
And I can't think of the legal term of it now. But Bill was trying to get the stockholders to vote one way. And he didn't have any luck, and he spent all his money, and he only had $10 left. And the meeting went, of course, against him. So he was very blue. And he was walking around the lobby of the hotel there, the Mayflower Hotel, wondering whether to go and get a drink. The bar was at one end of the lobby, and there was a church directory at the other end. And he looked at the church directory, and he thought, well, maybe if I call some of the old Oxford Group people, maybe I can get in touch with them, and maybe they can help me. So instead of taking a drink, he called up. He looked down the name of the ministers, and he picked one out because it had a funny name, the Reverend Tunks. So he called, Bill always liked names. He loved funny names. So he called up the Reverend Tunks just because it was a funny name. I mean, he chose that one because it was. Well, the Reverend Tunks turned out to be a very wonderful person, and he knew quite a lot of Oxford Group people, and he put him in touch. Gave him 10 names. Well, Bill, when he called these people, said, I'm a drunk from New York and I want to talk with another drunk. Wasn't really too much of an introduction. So, most people were very busy this afternoon. Or the weather wasn't suitable, or something or other. Somebody was sick. So he didn't get any of these 10 names until finally he came to the name of Seibeling, Henrietta Seibeling. But he knew that Seibeling was a big name in Akron. It was a tire company. And he couldn't imagine what Mrs. Seibeling would, but how she'd be interested in a drunk in New York wanting to talk to another drunk. But he called up Henrietta. And strangely enough, Henrietta was interested, and she understood exactly what he meant when he said that he wanted to talk to another drunk. And she said, I think I have just the person for you. And she said she'd call him. So she called up Dr. Bob. And Bob, this was Mother's Day, and of course Bob wasn't in any fit condition to go to Henrietta's. So Annie Smith, Bob's wife, said they were sorry, but they couldn't come. But as it was Mother's Day, Bob had brought her a plant and put it on the table, but Bob himself was under the table. So, that they try and come tomorrow. So they did. And Bill and Bob had a long talk there. Bob, very impatiently in the beginning, because he wanted to get back and drink, but finally became most absorbed. So, that's really where the two AA founders met. And AA, of course, had its ups and downs and took quite a long time, the early days, to get started. There wasn't any literature. There wasn't any means of communication from one group to another unless you went there yourself. So there was a lot of traveling in the old days between the groups. Well, to get back to my own reactions, of course, I was terribly happy that this wonderful thing had happened to Bill. And
I didn't realize that as time went along, that I was getting all kinds of queer reactions. It took me quite a long time to rebound from that cloud nine in the beginning. But I did, and I realized I wasn't anywhere near as happy. Why wasn't I happy? I couldn't understand it. Here, this wonderful thing had happened that I'd been working for my whole married life. This was 17 years afterwards, by the way. And why wasn't I happier? So one day, Bill said to me, let's get ready and go to the meeting. These were the Oxford group meetings that we used to go to. And I had a shoe in my hand, and I took it and threw it at him just as hard as I could. And I said, damn your old meeting. Well, I think I was more surprised at myself than he was. And I couldn't understand why I reacted so violently to such a simple remark, as he said, let's hurry up and go to the meeting. Well, it took me a long, long time to figure it out and to realize it, but this was the start of my thinking a little bit about myself in relation to Bill, in relation to other people, and in relation to God. I'd taken myself for granted. I had both the negative and positive result of trying to help him. I mean, I'd worked so hard, but I felt I was a failure at it. I hadn't done the bill what a wife with love should have done. In my family, when I was brought up as a child, we were a most loving family, and we felt that love was the ruler of the world. Love could do anything. My father and mother were a wonderful example and lived the life they preached, so that I believed thoroughly that the love between two people could do miracles. So that was why, one reason why this was such a devastating experience for me, that I hadn't been able to do it. And yet I knew at the same time that I had tried my best, and everybody told me how wonderful I was, how, of course my family didn't know very much about it, because they only knew we were drunk on occasion. They didn't know how much, because I didn't want to tell them, and I kept him away from them as much as possible. But I was very, very confused and didn't understand what it was all about, really. But I did begin to think about myself and wonder if I was this wonderful person that I had taken myself for granted to be. And going to these Oxford group meetings also helped me to analyze myself. Of course, I'd gone with Bill just for his sake, not for mine at all. So, after Bill had been in Akron, I went out there, and Bob had also tried the Oxford group. Bob and Annie were in the Oxford group, but it hadn't really of itself done anything for Bob. So Annie understood these things, and Annie and I used to talk. Annie was really a very wonderful person. She was a very wise, understanding woman. She was not a very active person. She wasn't very well, but AAs and hour-longs later used to come to her for advice. Many AAs would come and talk to her, because Annie seemed to be able to put her finger on them and what was the matter. So
as I said earlier, there was no way of communication except going places when AA was first started. We used to go everywhere, and when Bill would be downstairs talking with the AAs, which were mostly at that time men, there were very few AA women in the early days. The wives upstairs would meet with me, and we'd be playing bridge or doing something or other. But I'd tell them a little bit about my experience and how I'd come to realize that I, too, had to live by the 12 steps. That when I did realize that, everything became so much easier and happier at home. You see, my nose was broken because Bill and I had been so very companionable. We had lost all our friends. We had nobody but each other. And then, all of a sudden, the house was full of drunks. And Bill had little time for me. I mean, he had so many other things to do. And I missed his companionship. So I had to live within myself more. I mean, I had to know myself. I had to make my own decisions and not depend upon Bill so for my whole life as I had before. And I would tell these groups when we traveled around about this. And then, of course, AA began to really grow, and literature was written, and it wasn't quite so necessary for us to travel around, although we loved to do it still and did a lot of it for many years. But the literature was a tremendous help, and places like California could start on the literature alone without any personal contact. And then, as Ceci was telling you about the traditions, about how Bill was so anxious to have them pass, and then Bill got another idea. He thought that AA should have a conference of delegates, that the management of AA's affairs should be in AA's hands. So he took a trip around the country by himself, and this must have been in 49, by himself, I mean I didn't go with him, to sense the feeling of the country, the groups in the country, about having a conference of delegates. And he traveled all through the United States and Canada. And to his surprise, he found several groups of the wives of AAs. And they'd invited him to their meetings. And this was quite a surprise. He hadn't realized there were so many. And these had developed spontaneously. They had developed the way I had developed to realize that I needed the 12 steps. And they had developed, perhaps some, because Annie and I had told them about it, about our experience. And some of them were just what we later called coffee and cake groups, that were just their organizations, if you want to call it that, was just, they just helped AA hang out, pregnancy in the club, and make the coffee and things of that sort. They didn't have any spiritual problem of their own. So when he came back from this trip, he took me aside and told me that he thought that the families of alcoholics needed a fellowship similar to AA, that could a central office where people could write in and find out about it, where desperate wives could write, where groups could find out about other groups, a central office that would bring these groups into some sort of unity.
So he asked me if I would start such a thing. So, to be perfectly honest with you, I didn't want to. I had been with Bill through so much in the early days of AA, and we just recently moved to the country to a house of our own, which we hadn't ever had before, and I wanted to work in my garden and make slip covers for the soap. I didn't want to take time. I mean, I felt I'd done the job, I think. But I was really only starting. But when he convinced me of it, and I started, I became wholly absorbed. And Ann Bingham, another Ann, started the Al-Anon office with me, Al-Anon Central Office. We called it the Clearinghouse then. We wrote to AA, and to our surprise, quite a number of wives had written the AA office wanting to be registered. Well, the AA office, of course, is a place that registers only alcoholics. They didn't have any facilities for registering families. So, when we said that we would like to have those names and we would register them, that was just fine with them. So they gave us 87 names of people that had written into the AA office about help for families. So we wrote to these 87 names, and 50 of them said, yes, they'd like to join a fellowship of the families of alcoholics. So that really was the beginning of Al-Anon. But it was really Bill's idea to begin with. And I think if more AAs can realize that it was, they'd be more enthusiastic in the beginning about Al-Anon. Because Al-Anon, somebody really does for the homes what Bill and I were so very concerned about in the early days, because when the AA was sober and had joined AA, the family wasn't always happy, and we couldn't understand why this wasn't. We would think with this wonderful program that the family should be happy. But it was a one-sided affair. It needed both partners working together. And of course, that's what Al-Anon has done. And I hope these two fellowships will go along hand in hand for as long as God shall need them. Thank you.